Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of my Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
Doing well, Robert. How are you?
Doing well. Today on the show, we have a special bipartisan edition of my Old Kentucky Podcast.
We do.
Yeah, we had both Representative Jason Nemes from Jefferson County and Senator Morgan McGarvey from Jefferson County coming in to talk about their efforts to pass expanded sports gambling in the state of Kentucky. It was a really good, spirited conversation. We had elected legislators from both political parties in the state of Kentucky. So it was pretty cool. We're excited to share that conversation with you guys at the end of the show. Before that, though, we have some stories about jail overcrowding. We have stories about a strike in Anderson County and some information about voter registration that I thought we should talk about. And then quick hits. So without any further ado, Jasmine, tell us about jail overcrowding.
All right. So John Tilley is the Secretary of the Justice and Public Safety Cabinet. I'm a big John Tilley fan.
Which you work, you work around his department a lot.
Yes, right. I do. So last week he said that we are running out of room in Kentucky prisons, and he has urged the General Assembly to pass criminal justice reform to slow the growth of incarceration. So Secretary Tilley estimated that state prisons will run out of space by May of 2019, so less than a year from now, and that we're at capacity at all 76 of our full-service jails.
Ugh.
You know, another bad thing about this is that jails are housing over half the state's state inmates. So a state inmate is someone that has been convicted and they're supposed to be moved from jail to their state correctional facility, right?
So I've always heard this as a prison versus a jail. Is
right.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
But what this means that jails are housing over half the state's inmates, what that means is inmates are staying in crowded county jails with no programs instead of getting the correctional treatment in prison.
And when you say programs, that's like if somebody's incarcerated, sometimes it's a condition of their release that they go through a specific rehabilitation program, right?
Yes, that, but also just opportunities in general. Like if you're in a state prison, then you have more access to education, mental health treatment, just general groups and programs that they have at prisons. There's nothing in jail.
Jails are just like warehouses.
Right. You're just like laying on the floor.
Like literally the floor sometimes.
Right, because
yeah,
they're
right.
overcrowded. So there's nothing that you can get accomplished in jail. There is no rehabilitation there. So a lot of inmates with shorter sentences aren't getting moved to correctional facilities, or it's taking a really long time to get them moved. Mm-hmm. So that's bad. Last year, this is also bad, Kentucky reopened a private prison. And, you know, that's something Secretary Tilley said he doesn't necessarily support that, but it had to be done because we were overflowing, essentially.
I don't know, Jasmine, we could have just let everybody run wild, right? Just let them all out.
We could have, I guess, but, you know.
Private prison was considered a better option at the time than that, yeah.
Yeah, but it's not good, and I don't think Secretary Tilley supports private prisons at all, but that was something that was necessary because of the population problem that we have.
Mm-hmm.
One thing contributing to that is the denial of parole. Secretary Tilley says that the parole grant rate is much lower than it was expected to be.
Right, and parole is granted by, like, a group.
That's right, called, like an administrative board,
right?
Basically. And
how do you get to be on one of those?
I don't know.
We should get on one. We should have, like, the My Old Kentucky Podcast parole board.
But that's not surprising to me that the parole grant is low, because I have only had one client paroled.
Wow. Wow.
So My Old Kentucky Podcast has mentioned this several times before. I have, at least. But there have also been rollbacks to House Bill 63, which was a criminal justice reform bill passed in 2011. It did a lot of things. It created bail credit, which is rarely used, at least in Jefferson County. My experience is that bail credit's rarely granted. But it mostly did a lot with drug crime, basically, and, you know, focused on treatment over incarceration.
Nonviolent type stuff.
Right. But there have been rollbacks to that, such as doing away with the peddler distinction.
Mm-hmm. Which, that would be a nonviolent thing, but that's been rolled back, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So Secretary Tilley says, you know, these are the basic issues that we've had rollbacks. we haven't gone far enough. And also people are getting denied parole when we thought that more people would be paroled, essentially.
Right.
So then he made recommendations. So his recommendations are increasing the felony thresholds for thefts. It's currently at $500, and several states have already done that. I think Texas's is like $2,500.
Yeah, you've mentioned this before.
These are things we've all talked about before. He's just
reiterating.
Yes, exactly. bail reform, which I've talked about many times. I've written about it for our newsletter. Money bail reform is definitely necessary. Making possession felonies misdemeanors. So there's a lot of drug possession crimes that are nonviolent that are felonies.
Mm-hmm.
We can make those misdemeanors. Improving supervision practices. So that's, you know, the Department of Probation and Parole, just how they supervise people and how they can get people to not reoffend. That's mm-hmm. something we need to reform too. And finally, medication-assisted treatment for drug addiction, such as the Vivitrol shot, which is something that basically if you get the Vivitrol shot and then you go do heroin, you don't experience
the high.
Right. So that's something that he's in favor of. And there are several other types of medication-assisted treatment as well. But those were Secretary Tilley's recommendations, and he is asking the legislature to do something because we're running out of space.
Right. Okay, well, it sounds like something definitely needs to be done. There's a real problem, and maybe that will spur the legislature to action. We'll see. We'll see if that actually happens. We'll be paying attention. We've gotten some promises from people saying they want to pass criminal justice reform, and we're actively waiting, ready to see that happen in 2019. Jasmine, let's keep rolling with you. Tell us about the Four Roses strike.
All right, so Four Roses Bourbon main distillery is in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky. But then they also have a warehouse and bottling plant in Cox's Creek. Robert, do you know where Cox's Creek is?
Is that in Nelson County?
Part of it's in Nelson County. It's kind of right between Bullitt and Nelson County, and it's about halfway between Mount Washington and Bardstown.
All right. I was right. So, I was there. I was there last year. So.
Yeah, so it's very close to where I'm from. In both locations, in the main distillery and in the bottling plant in Cox's Creek, they are striking right now.
Mm-hmm.
Four Roses just went through a $55 million expansion. Workers from both facilities started the strike on Friday afternoon, and as of an hour ago when I looked, it's still going on.
Right.
It's been reported that 53 workers from three different unions are participating, and the reason is employees are unhappy about contract proposals, mostly regarding vacation, sick time, and seniority.
Right.
So the current proposal is basically a two-tiered system, which means that newer people get less.
Right. And this is a common tactic by management where they'll try to bring in people at a cheaper level. And then that means you're both less secure in your job as a more senior person.
Mm-hmm.
And also it means that the people coming in behind you just aren't making as much money. So
right. And so, you know, with unions, you might be paying the same dues as someone, but not getting the same benefits.
Yeah.
Employees even put an ad in the paper in Anderson County saying it was the worst contract proposal since Prohibition.
That's hilarious. Is there a bourbon plant?
Yeah, so this started on Friday. Four Roses didn't comment until Tuesday, and they said, "We value our employees and recognize that they're a crucial part of what makes Four Roses a special bourbon. We've been negotiating in good faith with the unions and offered a competitive package for our employees. It is our hope that the unions will reconsider their decision."
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think about?
I don't think they're going to reconsider. It doesn't seem like that's what the thing that they want to do.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Sure. So work has stopped, but tours are still going on. And there is also a Bourbon Heritage Festival this weekend.
Right. Yeah. The Bourbon Ball. Right. Yep. Yeah.
But there's no bourbon being made, it seems. But they're still giving tours.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw a photo, and Dustin Burley, candidate for the 53rd House District
friend
in Anderson
show.
County.
Yeah.
Yep, he's been on the show. I saw a picture of him protesting with workers in a photo, and some other like familiar names that you may have heard that have spoke out or been at the protest in support of the workers: Adam Edelin and Allison Lundergan Grimes, Richard Becker. He's one of the
He's a union organizer.
He's a union organizer.
Yeah, in addition to a candidate. He was a candidate in the primary, right?
Right. Josie Raymond, Charles Booker, Sherilyn Stevenson, James DeWeese, and Kathy Carter, all candidates that have spoken out in support of the workers, and a lot of them have even been down there and attended the protest.
Yeah.
So as of
this is, you know, that's a strategic move if you're a union looking to go on strike. Going on strike right before an election where Democrats are expected to do decent is a good idea because mm-hmm. you get a lot of support. A lot of people expressing their support for you. Yeah.
So as of today is Wednesday the 12th. They are still going strong and we'll see what happens. Yeah.
You know, Jasmine, I don't buy that much bourbon, but I said I'm not buying any Four Roses bourbon until it gets resolved.
I said that too. I don't buy much bourbon, but I do, you know, get a bourbon cocktail or an old fashioned or something when I go out sometimes. So I'm not buying any that have Four Roses.
No Four Roses.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, we'll see what happens with that. Hopefully they get that resolved quickly and in a way that, you know, it seems like that they invested in their plant, but they weren't willing to invest in their workers.
Yeah.
So that's not great. So let's hope that they come around on that, support their workers, that we can all share in this bourbon boom that's been going on in our state. All right, Jasmine, I have seen a couple of times in the recent past a story which first hit the AP Newswire. It was, you know, I saw it in WLEX, a station in Lexington, WFPL, the radio station here in Louisville, WSIZ in Eastern Kentucky. But in the original AP story, Adam Beam wrote about how, quote, Democrats have lost more than 2,500 registered voters statewide, while Republicans have added more than 58,000. Jasmine, that sounds bad, right? 58,000 versus negative 2,500, right? That seems bad, right?
Yeah.
It's a swing. That's a swing, of course, of more than 50,000 voters. Another big point that Mr. Beam made in this article is that Democrats have slipped below the 50% mark for the first time in a long time. Maybe ever. Maybe like since the beginning of the 20th century. Maybe before that. Jasmine, I'm obviously going to come at you with some stats and some facts here, but I'm not going to argue that this is good for Democrats. Of course it's not. On the face, it's clearly bad. It's bad to be in this position, but the context is very important. So, Jasmine, in January of 2017, Democrats had 1.68 million registered voters. So that's the scale we're talking about. We're talking about like seven figures. And back when they had 1.68 million registered voters, that was 50.6% of all total voters. And that was January 2017.
Mm-hmm.
During that same month, at the beginning of January 2017, Republicans had 1.36 million. So that's a difference of like 300,000 people. And that's like 40.9%. So, Jasmine, fast forward to now, with 20 months later, August of 2018, Democrats still have 1.68 million, so that, you know, loss of 2,500 people did not change the number from 1.68 million. But now that value is only good for 49.8%. And then the GOP, though, they have increased their numbers from 1.36 to 1.41. So they've gone from 40.9 to 41.6. So the total change for Democrats is negative 0.1% for Democrats. So looking at it in terms of percents instead of numbers, negative 0.1%. And even though that 58,000 number seems big for Republicans, that's only 4% of their total voters. So the total change, we're talking about like a change of about 4%. So I know that's a bunch of numbers, but it does beg a few questions. 4% gain in registration. That's what we're talking about here when we're hearing all these numbers. A 4% gain in registration, is that enough to actually move the needle in an election? Let's keep in mind first that turnout in elections, is especially midterm elections and gubernatorial elections, which are the next two that we have coming up here, is very low. And a midterm election is around 35% is something that we shoot for, and it was less than that in the primary. Jasmine, it's probably not going to work this way, but if it was true that new voters who just registered, you know, they voted just like everybody else at 35%, you know, that 50,000 number turns into 17,500. That's 35% of 50,000. So, you know, that's if you're looking at a 35% turnout, that's 1.18 million in terms of all Kentucky voters. You know, 17,000 out of 1.18 million, you know, Not really a big swing.
But do you think if they're newly registered voters that the rate might be higher than 35%?
I have no idea. And I thought about that a lot because when I was writing this, I was like, yeah, if you just register, but then you think like a lot of people who just register are signing up for voter registration drives because somebody's bothering you and telling you to fill in something. You get something mailed to your house, you might forget. I don't know. But they could be people who are more active and ready. I don't know if it's more than 35%. Less than 35% or right at it. I just don't know. I'm just saying if you take it at face value, if you think that they vote like everybody else. But Jasmine, let's leave all of that aside because the biggest point to make here is that voter registration does not equate to party identification. It just doesn't. Democrats have been losing the registration edge for a long time, but it's not like in a big numbers. You know, it's been a very slow process. But with the exception of the 2016 election, Democrats have actually fought to a draw in terms of the House vote. You know, of course, they won two of the past three gubernatorial elections, and they held the House of Representatives every election except for 2016. But there was a big swing in 2016, but that wasn't predicted by voter registration statistics. You know, Republicans won that race by like 9 percentage points and like by 20% plus in the presidential election. But that was not that we wouldn't have been able to predict that by looking at registration numbers.
Okay.
So these numbers, these registration numbers just don't seem to have any impact, or they don't seem to predict in any kind of way the election numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yes, the GOP has gained some, and that might bring them more in line to their actual vote totals across the state. But I would say don't pay attention to this at all. That's my big takeaway of all these numbers is just like whenever you read a story about voter registration statistics, ignore it. And I thought we should bring that up because it's been in the news a couple times.
Yeah, it has. And I think, you know, something to also think about is the number of registered Republicans that were upset this year by pension issues and things like that. So, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean voting record.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a good point. All right, Jasmine, before we get to our interview with Senator McGarvey and Representative Nemus, let's do some quick hits. Okay, Jasmine, on Monday, September the 10th, Governor Bevin said that indentured servitude was a good thing. So that's weird.
Can you explain more?
Yeah, so indentured servitude, if you don't aren't familiar with the term, it's an example of debt slavery that goes back to the 18th century. And essentially, like, if you're a European person, you're living over in Europe, you're in debt, you've got a lot of debt, you don't have the means to pay it off, you don't have a job or whatever. And you, what happens is you would be sponsored by somebody in North America, a European ancestor of European ancestry. You'd immigrate to North America as an indentured servant. You just work for that person.
I know what indentured servitude is, but what was the context of Matt Bevin's comment?
Right. So what he was basically trying to make a point about trade, and that point was not terrible. Like, he's like, hey, you should learn a trade and get a job, which, you know, yeah, that seems like a good idea. Like, if you mm-hmm. need a job, learning a trade and getting a job is a good thing. But he made that in the context of saying, like, hey, like indentured servitude, which is debt slavery. So, you know, yes, if you are in a position and unable to, you know, afford education and don't maybe have the grades you need, getting an apprenticeship or learning a trade is a good idea. But yeah, don't go into debt slavery. Debt slavery, you know, maybe more like a law degree, maybe, right?
That's true.
Yeah, that's more like indentured
so
servitude.
So where do you rank this, you know, on the Matt Bevin quotes?
I would say because there are so many incendiary quotes, this would be close to the bottom. But I would say,
yeah, I agree. If but it's still crazy.
But if Steve Beshear had said this, this would be number one. Like,
yeah,
it's mm-hmm. just the way that goes.
Yeah, this is not as bad as the kids are getting sexually assaulted because they're not in school.
Or can you believe that West End yes. kids play chess? Like, all that kind of stuff, yeah. Okay, another quick hit. The Kentucky Attorney General's office, it looks like they may follow Pennsylvania and a few other states' lead in investigating Catholic dioceses. There was a protest in Louisville recently, and the AG's office said that they would work with the legislature to draw up legislation that would create this investigation. And, of course, there's that blockbuster report in Pennsylvania about all of the sexual abuse that had happened at the hands of the Catholic Church to citizens in Pennsylvania. And it is really harrowing. It was really awful.
Mm-hmm.
And across the country, in places that have heavy Catholic populations, a lot of these governments are saying that they're going to, you know, do the same kind of looking into it to see what they can find.
Probably a good look.
Yeah, yeah. And Louisville has had trouble with abuse by priests. That's been something that's happened in town here that we've brought up before. And this Louisville Archdiocese did have to pay out some money about that a couple years ago. All right, Jasmine, a last quick hit, also equally bad. Everett Corley, who is the Republican candidate in District 43, where our friend Charles Booker is running, Mr. Corley has been responding this week to questions about his 2014 interview with William Johnson. Mr. Johnson is a white supremacist who runs what's called the American Freedom Party. A section of the interview between Mr. Johnson and Mr. Corley was about Mitch McConnell's marriage to Elaine Chao. And the quote is, quote, by the quote by Mr. Corley is, quote, interracial marriage, at least to Kentucky, is an insignificant. It attracts enormous attention, but at the end of the day, 95% of people who are white marry within their own people, unquote. So that's not not great. That's not a great quote to have. The Jefferson County GOP, after finding out about this, I think Philip Bailey was kind of the person that uncovered this. The Jefferson County GOP has disavowed Corley, and the Kentucky GOP has denounced his candidacy. So, you know, he didn't have a chance to win in the first place. Charles Booker is a really good candidate, and that's a very Democratic district. But, yeah, not great, not great. That's such an odd district, 43, because it includes, you know, it's got a lot of, it's probably the place of the most racial strife in Louisville, I would think is probably fair to say.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because that's Portland, and then also like a lot of East End precincts like Indian Hills and Mockingbird Valley and stuff like that, in addition to lots of West End areas. Like I think Shawnee is in there too, so interesting district for sure. All right, well, that's it for this part of the show. Let's listen to our interview with Morgan McGarvey and Jason Nemus.
Jason Nemus is a Republican representing the 33rd House District in Eastern Jefferson County. Mr. Nemus was first elected in 2016 after defeating incumbent Ron Krim in a three-way primary. Mr. Nemus is an attorney and served as Director of Administrative Office of the Courts, or AOC, as we've talked about on the podcast, from 2007 to 2009. Morgan McGarvey is a Democrat representing the 19th Senate District in Central Jefferson County. Mr. McGarvey was first elected in 2012, taking over for the retiring incumbent Tim Shaughnessy, and Mr. McGarvey is also an attorney. So these two legislators are part of a 9-member group looking to expand sports betting in Kentucky after the Supreme Court opened the door to the possibility back in the spring. So Senator McGarvey, Representative Nemus, welcome to Mount Old Kentucky Podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, yeah.
Okay, so there have been several expanded gambling measures that have been introduced on a bipartisan basis in the past dozen or so legislative sessions, and each year they fail. Representative Nemus, can you just tell me, to start off, what's different that will make this effort a success?
Well, we started off by making it a bipartisan and bicameral effort, and that's why Senator McGarvey and I, along with Senator Julie Rocky Adams, have put together Republicans and Democrats in the House and the Senate to craft this measure. So the difference is this is sports betting. And before now, states weren't allowed to pass sports betting or allow sports betting in their states except for four. That was a historical anachronism. But now that the United States Supreme Court has declared unconstitutional a congressional enactment that disabled states from moving forward, we can now move forward. And I think sports betting is something that's much more accepted than other expanded gaming efforts.
Yeah, there's not much I can add to that. I mean, Jason's right. What we've done in the past is we've tried to have full expanded gaming. That's a fancy way of saying casinos. I still think we should do that, and actually that's really the way we would get revenue for the state is to do that. But sports gaming is something that hasn't been allowed until now. A Supreme Court decision paved the way to allow states to legalize and regulate sports gaming. With that, you also see a move among states. Mississippi has already done it. I think West Virginia now has already done it. Pennsylvania's done it. It's not just Democratic coastal states. You're seeing people do this. And because of what Jason said, sports gaming is sort of accepted. I mean, look, here in Kentucky, we're the horse racing capital of the world. We already bet on sports throughout the year. Not just a horse racing capital of the world, but the college basketball capital of the world. I mean, who hasn't participated in an office NCAA pool? Who hasn't gone to a backyard party and a derby party and bet on the horses? There's an acceptance and a familiarity with sports gaming that I think gives us a much better shot of getting it passed.
That's right. And, you know, you don't even have to be at the facility. If you give me 2 minutes, I can place a bet on twinspires.com.
Right.
So it's accepted. It's here. This is a way to regulate it. It's and it's also a way to get some money off of it. And to those who might have been against expanded gaming in the past, one argument could be that this actually would tighten the screws on sports betting because it's happening, and it's happening by the millions already in Kentucky.
So, like both of you all just said, gambling's not unusual in Kentucky. The LRC estimated in 2003 that more than half of Kentuckians have gambled before. However, there are several other illegal vices which a large number of Kentuckians participate in. Senator McGarvey, do you think that your approach to gambling could possibly provide a roadmap for those who want to, for instance, legalize medicinal marijuana?
Yes, I do. And I think that what you have to look at is it's not a novel approach. This is coalition building. It's getting people from both parties and from different areas of the states. Because I think when you talk about issues like medical marijuana or sports gaming, increasingly you don't see a Democrat-Republican divide. You see an urban-rural divide.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's getting together, building those coalitions, finding common ground. So we've talked about sports gaming. You know, that the number you said, 50% had gambled. I bet that's not including NCAA office pools, right?
Right, I think that number is probably increasing,
yeah,
too.
I bet that number shoots closer to 100%. Well, that's what we're seeing with medicinal marijuana as well. You know, almost who doesn't have a relative or a friend or neighbor who has had cancer?
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor said, you know, it would really help you with your pain. You know, it would help you get better. And recommended medicinal marijuana. So it's the same type of thing. You see a familiarity with it, you see contact with it, and then you see sort of a coalition building in the legislature.
And I take issue with calling it a vice. I mean, it can become a vice if it's overused and people are spending money they ought not be spending. But I don't think putting $2 on the ponies is a vice.
Right.
I certainly don't think medical marijuana is anywhere close to being a vice. And so this is entertainment dollars. I mean, I guess one could go to the movies too often and spend money they shouldn't be spending. But
eat too much peanut butter.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I think I've eaten too many Snickers maybe. But the point is, I don't think it's a vice. I don't agree with that analysis.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
All right. There's a story by Jack Brammer of the Herald Leader recently about major sports leagues hiring lobbyists in Kentucky. Major sports leagues have shown to be supportive of sports betting as long as it includes something called integrity fees, which are royalties paid to leagues for hosting games which are bet upon. Representative Nemus, do you see these lobbyists as helpful to the effort of getting a sports betting bill passed, and do you support the idea of integrity fees?
I think they are helpful to getting it across the finish line, because these folks are, the lobbyists are well connected with legislators and with people who have information that can help us. So I welcome the lobbyists that have been hired, and I hope they hire even more. I want as big of a push as we can have. But I want to be very clear, there's not going to be integrity fees. I mean, why would Kentucky give that? No other state has given it. And whether Kentucky goes forward with sports betting or not, it's not going to make the difference in whether the Knicks cheat against the Celtics. So, I mean, our small population. But, you know, I would be open to some kind of a fee that would go, a royalty, whatever you call it, to the sports leagues if something's in it for Kentucky. You know, if they're going to put money into – you know, youth sports in inner city Louisville, for just thinking off the top of my head, you know, I could understand we might want to have that kind of a conversation, but an integrity fee standing alone is, I don't think any of the people on the group of nine, and I don't think any legislator I've talked to think that's a good idea.
I think calling it an integrity fee is just a fancy way of calling it a cash grab. I mean, we kind of see it for what it is in that respect, but you know, go back to your question about the fact that you do see these professional sports leagues hiring lobbyists coming to Frankfurt. I'm going to go with a glass half full approach here. I actually see it as a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I see it as a good thing is they wouldn't be hiring these lobbyists if they didn't think we had a chance of passing this
bill.
That's
right. Sure.
So you see these lobbyists descending on Frankfurt because they think we have a chance of passing it. And I think passing it is going to be a very good thing for Kentucky. And so I agree with Jason and everything he just said. If there's something we can work out where it's good for Kentucky, where it's the best thing for Kentucky, then we're going to work with these sports leagues. The fact that they are actively involved shows that they see the momentum that we're creating through this coalition.
And I think their involvement's not to be scared of. We shouldn't be scared of it. For instance, you know, we want to make sure that when we go to sports betting that we have we stamp out as much fraud as we can. And one way to do that is make sure that the statistics that everyone has access to are legitimate statistics.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to make sure that, you know, some bookie can't just make up things. That the sports leagues, I think, should be the official place where we get official statistics. So there's no monkeying around with those kinds of numbers.
Right.
And two thoughts on that to sort of piggyback on what you just said, Jason. I mean, I do, again, I agree with you. You know, number one, we always use lobbyist in the pejorative.
Right.
And when we're dealing with the lobbyists for these sports leagues, there actually is some expertise that we can glean from them. This is not the first time they've dealt with this. They've dealt with it in the other states. They've also dealt with this in other countries. I mean, America is actually not a very mature gaming market as compared to a lot of countries around the world. And so they're betting on these same leagues just as we are. So they do have some experience that we can use to make Kentucky's bill the best bill available.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, when you talk about that data, you know, I met with some of the PGA guys, and for instance, one of the things they brought up, they want to make sure that they do control the data. So for instance, if you have a prop bet on who hits the longest drive on a par five. They want there to only be one set of numbers so that the PGA says, you know, that drive was 400 yards and you don't have William Hill, which is a big gaming operator, mm-hmm. using its own data to say, no, it was only 396. You want there to be one set of numbers so that, that people aren't winning or losing based on someone's set of data.
Right. So for a long time, Kentucky has had trouble raising revenue to the level of spending that the General Assembly budgets. And in the past, expanded gambling bills have provided a dedicated revenue stream. These bills that, of course, haven't passed yet. A dedicated revenue stream would mean that the proceeds would go to a specific purpose. Senator McGarvey, do you support the idea of using hypothetical gambling revenue as a dedicated revenue stream?
I do, but similar in to the way I supported it with expanded gaming, which, by the way, I do support expanded gaming. I think we should have expanded gaming, including with sports gaming. But I think sports gaming has a better chance of passing. To the extent we dedicate revenue, I like to see a sunset provision on that dedication. And the reason being is, for instance, right now, I think pensions would be a great place to put a revenue source. And so it's because we have a real problem. But, you know, in 20, 25 years, we might not have that same problem. So I don't want to bind the hands of future legislatures, especially if we ended up putting in the Constitution, mm-hmm. by saying it always goes towards something, but would at least have a sunset provision in it.
Just as a quick follow-up to that, so I guess one of the things I think about when I think about a dedicated revenue stream is one of the more successful ones in Kentucky, which was the lottery, which went towards education. And that was kind of to build a new program. And you're kind of talking about it more in the sense of you know, funding something while it's needed for a while. So I guess we're kind of still thinking about the revenue from gambling as to, like, shore up the General Assembly's budget.
Well,
right?
And I should say that from what we see, revenues from sports gaming is not going to be enough to pay for something like the lottery did. And in fact, it's something we need. We shouldn't say no to this revenue, but this is not a cure for our budget problems.
Right.
I mean, we still need to do things like expanded gaming. We need to do things like medical marijuana. We need to do things like meaningful tax reform. That's where we need to go if we want to get revenue. This will generate revenue, but it's not going to be enough, I think, to in a meaningfully way support an entire program.
Right. That makes a lot of sense.
And even if it didn't generate revenue, why wouldn't we do it anyway?
Right.
Why is it the government's business whether I bet $2 on Red Sox versus the Yankees? It's just not.
So your coalition so far, looking at it, it's made up of legislators from urban and rural districts, and that kind of subverts that urban versus rural narrative that you talked about earlier. It's also made up of, you know, Republicans and Democrats, as is evidenced by the fact that you're both here. But one of the things that we thought was interesting is that none of the legislators in your coalition come from west of Bowling Green. And we pointed this out when we talked about it on the show, but we kind of see more like an east-west divide than an urban and rural divide. Representative Nemus, are you doing anything to bring along your colleagues in Western Kentucky at all?
Well, I'm talking to them. That's one thing. I haven't thought of it as an east-west divide before, but now that you say that off the top of my head, I think maybe that's right. I mean, even in my own party, the Republican Party, mm-hmm. you know, we say, well, that person's a mountain Republican, and that means something different than the Republican from
Absolutely.
Maybe Northern Kentucky even. Mm-hmm. And so I haven't thought that through yet on the east-west divide. But that's interesting. I'd like to think more about that. But what are we doing to bring our caucus along? Well, you know, we've worked very hard to get a lot of people on the Licensing and Occupation Committee, which is likely where the bill will go. The chairman, Adam Koenig, is a champion of this bill. We've worked with Senator Leader Damon Thayer mm-hmm. and a lot of other folks. And so we're picking up steam one by one and trying to get folks on board. And one of the things that we've done, and Senator McGarvey and I worked hard on this, is we believe that there is some legitimate opposition to this, and some folks are worried that people are going to be problem gamblers and that this will exacerbate mm-hmm. that problem. So one of the things that Senator McGarvey and others have done, Senator Adams is a big proponent of this, is we've tried to identify problem gamblers and actually do something about it. Mm-hmm. And with sports gaming, you can actually do that better because the data is electronic. It's real time. And so if Jason Nemus drops $5,000 when he's normally a $10 bettor, well, we can stop that. We can identify that. Mm-hmm. If somebody bets all the time at the beginning of the month, those are types of protections we can put into play here.
Mm-hmm. There are differences throughout the state, mm-hmm. and I think your premise is interesting, and I can definitely see that, even in the Democrats, mm-hmm. a difference between what are priorities in West Kentucky and priorities in East Kentucky. But as to why there are no West Kentucky members on this. It's not an intentional exclusion, mm-hmm. and we are speaking with members from across the state, from both parties in both houses. I think one thing when you look at it is this is a 9-member group. Part of the reason for that is, in my experience, the more people you put on these work groups, the less work actually gets done.
Right.
And one of the things that Representative Nemus did a good job of, and we certainly tried to be cognizant of when we were putting together this group, is who have been leaders on this issue in the past, right? To honor people who've done work on this before it was a major topic mm-hmm. from the Supreme Court. You know, so Representative John Sims, who's a member of the coalition, he proposed a bill last session in anticipation of the Supreme Court coming out with this decision, saying, let's be ready for it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a guy who deserves a seat at the table. He's put in a lot of work at this. He's been advocating for it. So he's not from the western part of the state, but he's clearly someone who has expertise and cares about it.
Right.
Same thing in the Senate when we put Senator Julian Carroll on the committee. Governor Carroll last session introduced a bill to get ready in advance of the Supreme Court. So now all of a sudden you've got, you know, Senator Julie Rocky Adams and I who've been proposing an expanded gaming bill for several years and been involved in this. We've just mentioned 5 of the 9 between Representative Nemus and Julie and, you know, Governor Carroll and John Sims. There's 5 of the 9 right there.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't include some of the other, you know, we wanted to get other people who've been involved. Certainly Northern Kentucky's cared about this issue a lot.
That's right.
But we are also, one of the things we're doing, besides looking at just the geographic diversity, we've been talking and calling legislators who we believe will be opposed to this. Because I think it's also important to get their opinions. What is it you oppose? Why do you oppose it? Even if you don't vote for it, what's your input on this that at least on the forefront might make it a better bill?
Because
ultimately that's what we want. We want a bill that's really good for Kentucky. And we have the opportunity, I think, to come up with some of the best legislation in the country.
Mm-hmm.
We have other states to look at. We have other countries to look at. And, you know, if we get the input from both sides, maybe we come up with something that not just passes, but other states model their legislation off of.
Sure.
You know, you do have several potential hurdles in your way next year. First, you know, some people think that a constitutional amendment is necessary to legalize sports betting. Because the Kentucky Constitution has some anti-gambling provisions. Why do you all think that amending the Constitution is not necessary?
Well, it's clearly not necessary. So if someone tells you it is, hand them a copy of our Constitution and say, point it out. So the Constitution says it sets up a lottery, and then it says that the General Assembly can't put together effectively other games of chance,
mm-hmm.
like a lottery. Well, this isn't a game of chance. Ask people who bet. You know, there are people who are professionals at this. And so, you know, this is not slot machines. Slot machines, you need a constitutional amendment, I believe. That's not what this is. So I think they're wrong, and I think they're just putting a procedural hurdle in the way. And I don't, you know, begrudge them that. If they're strongly against it, they need to use every argument they can. But there's I don't think it's very credible to say that we have to amend the Kentucky Constitution for sports betting.
Yeah, I agree with Jason. And in fact, in working on the expanded gaming bill for a number of years, we have proposed that as a constitutional amendment. But by the way, there are some people in Kentucky who don't think you need a constitutional amendment even for that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the problem is you've got a bunch of people who think you do and a bunch of people who think you don't, so therefore you'll probably end up with a lawsuit. We've always done the constitutional
No matter what, we'll end up with a lawsuit.
But that's actually, you know,
I'll bet you on that one.
when you asked me the question a few minutes ago about a dedicated revenue stream, I was actually thinking of the constitutional amendment. You know, I am much more opposed to dedicating revenue streams in the Constitution than I am dedicating revenue streams from the General Assembly. Mm-hmm. And I think so, a dedicated revenue stream for the right purpose, I'd be okay with in sports gaming.
Mm-hmm. Another issue that might face this bill is its committee assignment. Has your group discussed whether to start in the House or the Senate? And which committees would you like the bill to be assigned to?
I think, of course, it's the Senate President and the House Speaker that will make that determination. Mm-hmm. We believe it will go to the Licensing and Occupation Committee. I'll note that Speaker David Osborne has introduced this bill a number of times in the past, so he's in favor of it, strong proponent of it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the House, I'm pretty confident it will go to Adam Koenig's Licensing and Occupation Committee. In the Senate, I'm not sure where it'll go. I guess it's I know Leader Thayer is in favor of it, and as to where it starts, wherever it has the best chance of passing quicker. I think we should probably put, what do they call, mirror bills, Morgan?
Companion bills.
Companion bills, yep. And then try to just run them at the same time. But you know, the process is, I'm just a greenie, freshman, so, but the process, whatever the best chance to get it passed is mm-hmm. good for me. I don't think anybody that's involved here has pride in authorship. Mm-hmm. And so whether it comes from McGarvey's side or Nemus' side, we don't really care about that.
I think we will run what they call companion bills. We'll introduce the same bill in the House and the Senate, see who runs with it first. I think it, importantly, I think it can come out of either chamber. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is there might be some people who argue this is somehow a revenue bill, which mm-hmm. means it would need to originate in the House. I don't. I think this can come out of either chamber. If I had to bet today, I would probably say the House runs with it first, but that's right. just a total guess, and a lot can change.
Right.
First of all, we are going to have change. I mean, there's going to mm-hmm. be an election before then, so that's where it stands today, but we'll see what happens once right. we get there next January.
So still a ways to go in terms of the tactics about how it will be passed, but we'll definitely be paying attention. So lastly, before I let you guys go, it's always really nice to see bipartisan work on any bill, and I really think it's great to have you both on here because both of you intentionally seek out the opportunity to work across the other side. We've seen that on both of your careers so far. So first of all, tell us why you do that and why you think working in a bipartisan nature is just necessary or a good idea generally.
First of all, I hold a belief that the best policy and the policy that's ultimately successful in the long run is policy that has buy-in from both parties. We can just go throughout history and start naming all the examples of policies that have had trouble because they couldn't, you know, get affirmation from the other side of the aisle. So I think it's important when you have big policy measures to get other people involved. I think it's important for the success of the legislation you're advocating. Now, I can also say with me, it's a little bit of a necessity. Legislation is coalition building. But when you're in the super minority, as I am,
right.
that coalition must necessarily include the majority.
that makes sense.
You know, so I'd like to be altruistic about the entire process. But no, I mean, I'm in a double super minority in Frankfurt. So in order to get legislation passed, you have to reach out across mm-hmm. the aisle. And I say that because I don't think people understand how Frankfurt works sometimes. The majority has an inordinate amount of power. Mm-hmm. The majority controls committee assignments. The majority controls which committees' bills are assigned to. And the majority ultimately determines which bills come through those committees and get voted on the floor. Mm-hmm. So if you can't work across the aisle and you can't present your ideas and accept criticism and feedback in a rational way and be willing to compromise on some things, you know, you have to then be willing to not let your bill pass. And so mm-hmm. there are some bills where, you know what, I wouldn't change them. I believe in them, and those are bright line bills. Most of those bills haven't passed. Mm-hmm. There's not always room for compromise on legislation. Mm-hmm. Where there is room for compromise, you can come up with an idea supported by the other party. Then I think if you handle it in such a way that you do have a chance.
Yeah. And Senator McGarvey, we fully understand your reasoning. If you want to get legislation passed, which not everybody in the Democratic Party that serves in the legislature really wants to get stuff passed, it seems like sometimes. But Representative Nemus, you know, it's not as necessary for you. So tell us a little bit why you like to do it this way.
Yeah, at least for the 2 years I've been there, it's not been necessary. But the reason I do it is because Senator McGarvey's smart. Mackenzie Cantrell, representative from the 38th District, she's smart. And so these are people who reach their positions in good faith, and we don't come at it from the same direction a lot of the time. Sometimes we do, but a lot of the times. And isn't it better for policy that we have people of good faith who are smart looking at it coming to it from different angles? I mean, that's good. The worst part, somebody said, what's the worst part about Frankfurt? The worst part about Frankfurt, and I fear it's even worse in D.C., is that because I'm a Republican, Democrats are supposed to demonize me, mm-hmm. and they're supposed to not work with me and think I'm a certain type of person. And because they're Democrats, I'm supposed to do the same. And it just doesn't make sense. I endorsed a Democrat for re-election this year. I got a call from an important person in my party saying, what are you doing? You can't do that. Well, watch me. I mean, that's what we should be doing. And, you know, I'm endorsed by a couple sitting Democrats in the House right now. And that's what how we ought to be behaving, because it's good for policy, and it's just good for not only because of the substance of the policy, but procedure matters and attitudes and civility. Those kinds of things do matter. We're not always going to get along, but when we approach a bill, we ought to be trying to go on both sides of the aisle. That should be the presumption.
Yeah, no, and you know, Jason brought something up that I've got a 6-week-old at home, so I'm a little slower today than normal. But you know, there are really good people who serve in the General Assembly from both sides, and you mentioned intelligence. There's a lot of really smart people, but it's also perspective. You know, when I come from the Highlands with a piece of legislation, it's important, you know, I see how it affects the people who live in my district, but I don't think about how that might impact someone who lives, for instance, in Senator David Givens' district. He has a much different day-to-day experience than I do. It's important to get that perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think once people know that you're willing to work in good faith, because that's what it is. You know, right. If you're willing to work in good faith and you want sincere feedback on issues and are willing to internalize that and accept some of it, then people want to work with you. Mm-hmm. And so you can get that and you can make legislation better. Now, I think Representative Nemes, I think Jason, you'd agree, too, there are some issues for both parties where there isn't room for that compromise, mm-hmm. right? You know, but by and large, what we do at a state government level, mm-hmm. it's important to distinguish between the state and the federal government. What we do at a state government level, I think there is room for people to work together and to craft legislation that becomes then the best legislation we can pass.
That's right. And, you know, fundamentally, I would also say it, I'll just speak for myself. I think that's who I am.
Yep.
You know, I represent a district that is not far right or far left. I represent a district that's right, but not, you know, crazy. And so, and that's also who I am and who my wife is and who my father and mother and mother-in-law, that's who we are, is some people who try to get along with folks. You know, we have, I'm an unapologetic Republican, and I have beliefs that I hold, but, mm-hmm. You know, it's not extreme either way. Mm-hmm. And I think our people demand us to get along. I think, you know, 40 to 50 to 60% is in the middle, and we need to be more toward the middle. I think that's where better answers are found.
Absolutely. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us today. We really do appreciate you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter at @myoldkypod. We have a Facebook page you can like. You can find our podcast on the podcasting app of your choice. We have a Patreon that you can subscribe to and sponsor us at patreon.com/myoldkentuckypodcast. And we have a weekly newsletter that comes out on Fridays, and you can subscribe to that at tinyletter.com/myoldkentuckynewsletter.
All right, everybody, thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.